Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday and Sunday right here on KTEP. We are visiting with Dr. Joshua Muravchik. Dr. Muravchik is a fellow at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He is also the author of hundreds of articles appearing in major U.S. newspapers, and his latest book is Making David into Goliath. First of all, we'd like to welcome Dr. Muravchik to our show. Thank you very much for being with us here today.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a great pleasure.
You are a professor at the Institute of World Politics in Washington, which are also a fellow at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. And the Wall Street Journal calls you as maybe the most cognate and careful of the neoconservative writers on foreign policy. So, with that, we're going to take off and talk a little bit about this book that you just came out with, Making David into Goliath. One of the things that's interesting, Joshua, is the fact that, and I heard your talk that you gave at the Heritage Foundation, you talked a little bit about what happened 50 years ago. Whenever anything happened with Israel, the United States and just about everybody else was on Israel's side, but then all of a sudden things started changing. What caused this to change over the years? Some people think it's just happened suddenly. It's just over the last few years, but it goes back a lot further than that.
Well, it does, Louis. And Louis, we talk to each other on first name, so it does, Louis. It was, you know, there was a time when Israel was very popular, where it had just a great deal of support and sympathy around the world. And that was true at the time of the Six-Day War in 1967. And people remember the novel Exodus, which told about the birth of Israel, and that was the best-selling novel since Gone with the Wind. People loved that story of how Israel was created out of nothing by refugees from Hitler and what have you. But over a period of decades, that sympathy was just worn away and turned around until today. I think Israel is treated as the number one pariah of the so-called international community. I hasten to add, really in the United States, among the American people, there's still preponderant support and sympathy for Israel. But around the rest of the world, it's just the opposite. And of course, with the world being so hostile to Israel, that does have an impact on the U.S., including on the U.S. government, which in turn gets pressured by other governments that are, and by the UN, which are unfriendly to Israel. So we've had this remarkable turnaround, and it couldn't have happened all at once because it was such a huge change. You know, the only other thing that I can recall ever in history where countries go from being loved to hated or hated to love is if the countries themselves get turned upside down. They have a revolution and completely change the kind of government or political system they have. But nothing changed in Israel. What changed was the way the rest of the world looked at Israel. So that really is kind of unique, and it couldn't have happened all at once. It happened in a process over decades. And as I studied it to write this book, I found there were two kinds of forces that converged to bring about this change. One was just sheer physical or material pressures. That is, there was a lot of intimidation of Europe and of the moderate Arabs by the Arab terrorism starting in the 1970s. And the people really wanted to appease that. And then secondly, there was the Arab oil boycott and the threat of future boycotts. And that really brought Europe and Japan to their knees, they being completely dependent on Middle Eastern oil imports. And then there's just the sheer weight of numbers. You know, for every Jew in the world, there are 100 Muslims. There's one state of Israel, 22 Arab states, 57 member states of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And that's a lot of diplomatic and economic weight thrown into the scales against Israel. Those are what I bundled together and called the physical or material pressures that were brought to bear. But then there was an intellectual process which was not specific to Israel in the Middle East. There was a broader intellectual change going on, but it had very dramatic effects on Israel and the Middle East, and that was a different way of looking at the world from the leftist progressive perspective. I was a leftist myself in my youth. I know it well, and for about a century, the main core of the leftist progressive way of looking at the world was class struggle. It was all the poor against the rich or the workers against the capitalists, and that was the sort of the noble struggle that would make the world a better place when finally the poorer people, the workers, whatever, would triumph. But that model had been around for about 100 years and just seemed to lose some of its pizzazz as an exciting idea in the latter part of the 20th century. And what came up that seemed more exciting was the national and ethnic struggle. It grew out of the anti-colonial movements and the civil rights struggle in the United States, and it came to be called by some the rest against the West, or the people of color against the white man. And if you see that as the most exciting moral drama that's going on in current era of world history, well then, through that lens, Israel looks like the westernized white guys, and the Arabs and Palestinians portray themselves as the anti-colonial people of color, and you naturally support them rather than the Western white guys.
What happened after the Six-Day War in 1967? Because, as you mentioned in your book, after that, there was overwhelming support for Israel. In fact, I think you say in your book that France, supporters of Israel, outnumbered Arab sympathizers something like 25-26-1.
Yeah, it was overwhelming, yes.
And then after that, when Yasser Arafat and his Palestinian Liberation Organization and the sponsorship of China and the Soviet Union, all of a sudden things were changing because they gained a place on the global revolutionary left.
That's right. Several things happened in 67. One thing was that just that a lot of people on the eve of the 67 war, the Arabs mobilized their armies on Israel's borders. They said they were going to annihilate Israel. And no one knew for sure that they wouldn't or couldn't. And so a lot of people elsewhere felt a fear for Israel's survival. And after Israel won such an overwhelming victory, Louis, people never again feared so much for Israel. And they looked upon Israel not as weak and threatened, but as a very strong military power. So that was one part of it. But there were also some other more subtle things, changes that happened in 67. And you've just pointed us toward one of them that was probably the most important, which was it paved the way for the birth of the idea of Palestinianism, of the Palestinian people, Palestinian nation. That idea had not been there before. Well, it had been in the minds of a few individuals, but it wasn't on the world map, so to speak, mental map, and it wasn't even in the minds of most of those whom we now call Palestinians. There was the hot idea, the exciting, the big idea in the Arab world in that era was pan-Arabism, that all Arabs should be together in sort of one omnibus state. And that was the thing that most young Arab intellectuals look to, including young Palestinian intellectuals. That would be the way to move forward. And the great expounder of that idea was Egyptian President Nasser. And he was the most charismatic figure in the Arab world at that time. And I dare say he was the most charismatic figure in the Arab world ever in modern history. And Nasser, obviously sort of had an image of himself as the leader of this omnibus Arab state. And lots of others accepted that. But then the 67 war, which was largely created by Nasser, was seen as a devastating humiliation to him. In fact, he even resigned and then went back into power. But when Nasser's prestige was destroyed, as it was, the idea of pan-Arabism sort of just it let the air out of the balloon. It was no longer the it seemed like a hot and exciting idea, and that cleared the ground, so to speak, for the rise of particular nationalisms among the Arabs, and including the birth of Palestinian nationalism. And there had been, as I said, a few guys who had this idea, led by Yasser Arafat. They were outside of the Palestine Liberation Organization, which actually had been created by Nasser a few years before 67. Arafat and his little clique were outside of it, but when pan-Arabism was discredited, then Arafat and his friends started pushing for Palestinian nationalism. It kind of caught on amongst more Palestinians, and in the next years, they moved into the PLO and took it over and made it a kind of voice of Palestinianism. And they spread that kind of national identity among the Palestinians. They made the whole world aware of it by dramatic acts of terrorism, a lot of airplane hijackings and massacring Israeli Olympians at the 72. Olympics. And through all of this, they put Palestinian nationalism on the map. And that really changed the conflict, or at least the world's image of the conflict, because up until then it had been the vast Arab world against little Israel, and now it became little Israel, but little but strong Israel, because everyone saw that Israel was really strong, against the much littler, tiny, weak Palestinians. So Israel, instead of David, started to look like Goliath.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Joshua. In the charter, the PLO's charter, it does not state anywhere about a Palestinian state, does it?
No, in the Palestine National Charter that was adopted when the PLO was formed, it didn't speak of a state. It didn't even speak of the Palestinian people as having sovereignty, as being a sovereign people. They were just part of the Arab nation, the broader Arab nation. And the rhetoric of that era was, well, if we can liberate Palestine, not as a country, but as an area that had been usurped by the Jews, if we can push the Jews out and liberate Palestine, that will be the catalyst for unifying the whole Arab world into one Arab state. It was not to create a Palestinian state.
And at that point, is it was one of those turning points also as far as like the rest of the world going, okay, so it's Israel is now Goliath, not David.
Right. So then, there was suddenly this new plaintiff, so to speak, this new figure in the drama, the Palestinian people looking for having their own country and being blocked by Israel. And, of course, it was also true that in the 67 war, Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza, which Israel seized from Jordan and Egypt, respectively. They had not been an independent state, but they were part of the broader area called Palestine, but they had been part of Jordan and Egypt. Israel, in fighting Jordan and Egypt, occupied those two territories, and there were a couple of million Arabs who lived in them, who were, their identity wasn't so distinctly Palestinian, it was more of an Arab-Muslim identity, but they were the Palestinian Arabs, and then they developed this sense of nationalism, wanting their own country, and then Israel was suddenly an occupying power, occupying this Palestinian territory that the Palestinians were saying, you know, was part of what they wanted for their national home.
One of the things the Arabs did, and this is mentioned in your book also, is, and you mentioned it briefly already, about pressures, both material and academic. The material, of course, being oil, where countries, the Arab countries, said that they would withdraw oil or withhold oil from anybody who tried to help Israel. But then academic-wise, you mentioned in the book and also in your talk at the Heritage Foundation, the fact that Britain or Australian universities, I don't remember which one, had academic boycotts of Israeli universities.
Well, that's current. That the it was Britain.
Britain, yes.
And okay. And it was the British Teachers Union voted for academic boycotts of Israeli universities as a way of showing their hatred for Israel. And even there have been a number of cases where academic journals published in Britain, scholarly journals in obscure fields, you know, I think not in my field, nothing that I would ever read or even know existed, but they when they received some submissions of academic articles from some Israeli scholars, they said, oh, we're not publishing anything by Israelis.
And that was the same case also as far as former late professor Edward Said. He came out and spoke strongly against academic courses, and also, in fact, at some point called you an intellectual charlatan.
No, he didn't call me an intellectual charlatan. I called him an intellectual charlatan.
Oh, okay, charlatan. Okay. Sorry there.
And I'd be happy to tell you why. Shall I?
Go right ahead.
He was a charlatan. He was, and the reason this is amazing and shocking, Louis, is that according to one web search, his books are assigned in almost 1,000 courses at American universities. Even some of the big universities like UCLA and Georgetown have courses just on the subject of, quote, the thought of Edward Said. So he's about as influential as it gets among American academics. He was a Palestinian American. But his main book was a book titled Orientalism. And it sounds obscure, but it became immensely influential. And I know students in Ivy League schools who have been assigned it more than once because of different courses assigning it. And this book, what it really claimed to show was that all Europeans and Americans are inherently, as he said, racist and imperialist against the Orientals. And by Orientals, we often use that word to think about China and Japan, but he meant
Middle East.
The Middle East. He meant Muslims and Arabs in particular. And what he did in this book was he purported to study the writings of scholars, really mostly in the late 19th and then early 20th century, who wrote about the Middle East, and he brought out quotes to show that they were racist and imperialists, and they had contempt for the Middle Eastern people. But the way he did that, the reason I call him a charlatan was, what he did was he looked for quotes that were racist, and you can find them. Of course, you could find them going in any direction for, you know, almost any.
Sure. If you're looking for it, you can find it.
If you look for it, you can find it. And then some of the people whom he quoted were not students of the Middle East at all. They were miscellaneous write, you know, travel writer, novelist, what have you. Some of them were scholars of the Middle East, but they had many quotes, and he took, you know, some little line out of context, and really their thought about and the way they treated the Middle East was really not at all contemptuous as he claimed it was. And some of them were truly condescending, and you could make the charge stick. But in other words, he took racist quotes from people who were really not necessarily even in the field or important in the field. And then there was a body of work by people who were really important Orientalists, students of the Middle East, who were tremendously admiring of the Arab-Muslim Middle Eastern culture, and whose whole work showed their admiration, and he left those people out entirely. So rather than take, you know, what any scholar is supposed to do is you take a, if you want to make a point about some group, you take a fair sample of their work or their statements. He only selected the statements that tended to fit with his accusation or his hypothesis and suppressed all the evidence to the contrary. And, you know, you can do that in a barroom argument, but a scholar cannot do that, and that's why I called him a charlatan.
Now, what about who some people call the granddaddy of Islamic studies or Muslim studies, and that is Ignaz Goldziher?
Well, that's the perfect example. This Ignaz Goldziher was a Hungarian, a Jewish Hungarian, who is called by many the granddaddy of Muslim and Arab studies, and he actually spent many years in the Arab countries. This is like in the late 1800s, just living among them and studying them. And what happened, and he's completely left out of Said's book, although arguably he was the most important Orientalist of them all. And his attitude was exactly the opposite of what Said attributes to the Orientalists, and I just selected one quote from Goldziher because it shows it so clearly. He said, quote, "I discovered that Islam was the only religion which can satisfy philosophic minds. My ideal was to elevate Judaism to a similar rational level." You couldn't, end of quote, you couldn't be more admiring than that. That is, you know, I've studied this other religion, and my great hope is to raise my own religion to the same high level. You couldn't be much more admiring than that, and yet, and you couldn't be much more influential in the field than Goldziher was, and yet, so Said just, you know, suppressed the evidence, as they'd call it in a court case. He just completely left out Goldziher so that no one would know that there was this contrary evidence.
Now, getting back to present day now, Joshua, a lot of people, as you mentioned, have turned against Israel, and Israel is now considered the giant Goliath and not little David anymore. In fact, you mentioned that there was a Swedish newspaper that brought out the headlines that Israelis were slaughtering people from Hamas to harvest organs.
Well, it wasn't from Hamas. It was even worse than that, because this came out at a moment when there was no fighting going on. This came out in 2009. There was no fighting going on at that time. There had been actually, a war in Gaza the December to January 08 to 09, but this came out late in 09 when that was long over. There wasn't any fighting going on, and the widest circulation, the most popular daily newspaper in Sweden, its name is Aftonbladet, carried the story that Israelis were just slaughtering Palestinians, not in battle, just as a business. They were going out and randomly slaughtering individual Palestinians and then removing their organs to sell them. And it turned out some other reporters looked into it, and there was, of course, it was false, and there wasn't even a shred of evidence behind it. The reporter had just made it up, essentially. There was a single Palestinian who had died somehow, and he had had an autopsy, and so there was an incision on his chest where the autopsy was, and but when other reporters, and that was where the story grew out of, but when other reporters went to the family of that man and said, and are you accusing the Israelis of having harvested his organs? They said, no. So this Swedish reporter had just made the whole darn thing up. But what amazed me and what actually prompted me to write this book was that a leading newspaper would publish it. Maybe a reporter goes nuts, but you're supposed to have an editor and some sense of responsibility that you can't just invent, slanderous tales. And so I asked myself, how did we get to a situation in which these editors would think, oh, this story makes sense. We're going to, feature it in our newspaper, a leading newspaper. Israelis have a business of slaughtering Palestinians for organ harvest. And I thought, boy, the world has really gone crazy. This is not just a matter of saying I disagree with Israeli policy, or they should get out of the settlements, or they shouldn't be fighting so much in Gaza, whatever. You can disagree with policies, but to have an image of Israelis where it's a plausible story that they're doing something as ghoulish as this just struck me that the world had gone mad. And so that's how I got the idea to try to write a book about how the world had turned around about Israel.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Josh. We've been visiting with Dr. Joshua Muravchik. Dr. Muravchik is a fellow at Johns Hopkins University. He is also a professor at the Institute of World Politics in Washington. The book is Making David into Goliath, How the World Turned Against Israel. And that's available, of course, at various bookstores, online, Amazon.com. And you can also Google Dr. Muravchik's name and find out more information about that. Joshua, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Oh, Louis, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I want to let you know that the views expressed during this program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KTEP. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.